Welcome to another episode of Harvest Series, a podcast following a four-day experience in Kaplankaya on the southwestern Aegean coast of Turkey, filled with fascinating talks and workshops to harvest knowledge and nurture the planet, an event produced by Athena Advisors and Capital Partners.
Within the departments of environment, both in China and in the EU, there are regular discussions that take place, you know, how both of them are moving their policy forward. And they wanted a secretary for those discussions who was neutral and acceptable to both. And we're it. We are the secretary to those discussions between the EU and China. And there's something quite remarkable about this, that a little environmental organization, 350 people, with an office sort of just down the road, you never know it was there, is right in the middle of the dialogue between the EU and China. I mean, we're able to do it because we have no angle on this. We just want to see the world in a better place.
I am Rose, a French journalist based in Barcelona, and this episode is an interview made in London with Howard Covington. He's the leader of the Board of Trustees for one of the leading climate change organizations, Client Earth. We will first talk in this episode about the most pressing environmental challenges we're facing, and we'll move on quite quickly to the actions that we can take, and in particular, the choice that Howard made to join Client Earth and to develop it, not scared to sue governments like Poland or the UK that don't follow their own environmental laws. Howard will share how Client Earth got involved also with China and contributed to China finally not building power plants outside of the country for the Belt and Road Initiative. I really enjoyed this episode, and I'm excited to share this exploration of environmental challenges, action, and Howard Covington's impactful journey with Client Earth.
Hello, Howard.
Hi, Rose.
Thanks for being here.
Very good to be here.
So could you please tell me what are, for you, the three biggest challenges our planet Earth is facing as human being on this planet?
So, Rose, I don't think I can, because I think three is an inadequate number.
Why?
Because you can look at the challenges facing us in several different ways. And in each way, you can find a whole host of challenges. So okay. Let me give you an example. We are pushing the climate through some kind of transition. We're warming it up by putting carbon into the atmosphere. That all by itself is a major problem. But we're also taking a scythe to nature. Everywhere we humans go, we are trying to reduce biodiversity and replace the natural world with the cultivated world or the pasture world on which we put cows and sheep and so on. That is a major problem. Interestingly, we have the technologies to solve the problems we are creating. We know how to stop emissions. Our technologists, our scientists, our entrepreneurs have done a wonderful job in producing what we need to replace fossil fuels with wind and solar and batteries and electric vehicles and nuclear and all the things that we need to run an energy system without fossil fuels. But another big problem is that we don't have the politics to drive this forward as quickly as it should go. And I don't need to say what the political problems are in any detail, but just to mention too, there is the strategic competition between China and the US. At a time when one would like them, from a climate and nature point of view, to be working closely together. Mm-hmm. Within the US, there is a polarization which is unbelievable in its extent, with the possibility that the Republican Party, by pushing the election of Trump, will essentially abandon democracy if they succeed in getting him elected. And if that happened, it would be terrible for the West and terrible for the leadership of action on climate change and the destruction of nature. There are deep issues of social justice and fairness. It is completely understandable that some groups within countries and some countries think not enough is being done for them to help them cope with the demands of reducing emissions and saving nature. And until the issues of social justice are properly addressed, I fear that the energy transition that we need and the action to reduce our attack on nature will not go fast enough. I could go on.
Yeah, so we're more than three now. Okay.
But in stating these issues, the interesting thing about them is that we humans, we know how to deal with each of them. There's nothing stopping us other than ourselves. We have the technology, we have the money, we can solve the problem. So there is a pathway through this.
What's the future? What do you see? What's our level of action? What can we do?
Each of us is capable of taking action. And there's a great virtue to taking action. If you are optimistic and you take action, you have a sense of some control. You are doing something to solve the problem. Now, what I have found, is by joining with a group of people who are taking action that you feel personally is effective, is in character with the way you like to proceed in life, that gives you a great sense of making progress. So I'm referring in my own case to Client Earth, but other people will have other environmental organizations which suit them in a way.
Yeah.
And I think joining with people to support an environmental organization gives a great sense that you're doing something and that you're moving the world towards the solution.
So before giving me your actions at Client Earth, because you're the chairman of the board, can you tell me how you joined this adventure and what does it represent for you?
The story of how I joined it is a slightly funny one. I had a career in the City of London. I was a banker and a money manager, and I co-founded a business and sold it. And after I sold it, I had reserved time for looking at climate change and the destruction of nature. All the time I was building the business, I knew that this was a growing problem. This was in the 2000s.
Okay.
But I didn't have time to study it. So I did study it, and it didn't take long to study it. By 2010 or something, there was lots of information available. I have a scientific background. It was easy to pick out the key bits of information and to see where the world was headed. I did that. My eyes were opened, as it were, and I put together a little presentation and went all around the city talking to my former colleagues saying, let me tell you, I've now had time to study this. This is how it looks. Where the climate is changing, we're destroying nature. In the end, this is going to come back to bite us. There's going to be a big cost to this, and it's going to affect everything we all do. And they all said, it's very nice to see you, Howard, but you're talking complete nonsense. So
why would you say that?
Because this was in the early 2010s, and nobody other than the scientists were really thinking about the problems. It wasn't something that was discussed generally. I mean, it was beginning to bubble up, but it hadn't reached the city at all. It hadn't reached the financial institutions.
But it didn't discourage you?
It didn't discourage me. And I read about Client Earth and some of the early actions it was taken. And I got in touch with its founder, James Thornton, and we had lunch. And I told him the story I've told you. And I said, now I want to sue them.
So who did you want to sue? The person?
I didn't mind who I sued. I just wanted to see. I had tried to persuade and it didn't work. I bumped into...
So the big corporations.
The finance. The finance houses in the city who wouldn't take any notice. Okay. And there was at the time, one would say nowadays that they were climate deniers, but they weren't really climate deniers. They were just dismissing the whole issue. I thought it would be, I shared James's view that the best place to have a discussion of climate change was in a court in front of a judge. A judge would weigh all the evidence and make a judgment based on the facts. There was no dismissal or denial. The judge would assess the arguments.
It was new for Client Earth?
Client Earth was founded in 2007. We were having this conversation in, 2012 or something. So Client Earth was on its way. It had 40 people at the time. Has 350 people. The size of Client Earth has grown at 20% a year. It's a startup. It was a startup, and it's gone through this very fast growth.
Yeah, middle size now. That's
good. We have 350 mouths to feed every year. And James and I shared a view that the law was a very powerful tool in bringing about the change of behaviour that you need to get emissions reduced and to protect nature. I mean, it's called Client Earth. The firm is called Client Earth because essentially it's a law firm with just one client, mm-hmm. the Earth.
Yeah, beautiful. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And so can you give examples of some lawsuits you've won?
James was very thoughtful about how to go about using the law in Europe. He was a lawyer who had won many cases, environmental cases in the US, and he wanted to come to Europe and develop the same thing here. And he saw that the biggest polluter in terms of pollution per head, the biggest carbon emitter was Poland, where it had an energy system completely powered by coal-fired generators, and they were pretty old coal-fired generators, so they were pretty dirty. And so he set up an office in Poland, and every time there was an application to build a new coal-fired power plant, he would bring an action against the applicant to test whether it satisfied Poland's own environmental regulations.
Okay.
So did the applicant obey the law in making the application? And they never did. We stopped 30 coal-fired power plants. Since we opened an office in Poland, there has not been a new coal-fired power plant.
Amazing. Okay.
It's absolutely amazing. We have contributed to transforming the attitude of the Polish people and their government to energy generation. And now, of course, they are thinking through how they should make an energy transition. So that was one example back from the 2012, 13, 14, something like that. But, another one which I think made Client Earth's name in Europe was the British government and its attitude to clean air. So the British government brought into British law the EU regulations for air quality. It then proceeded to completely ignore them. Mm-hmm. And we pointed out in around 2015, we pointed out to the British government that the air quality in British cities was a mile away from what the UK government's own law said it should be. And the British government said, essentially, so what? And so we said, we'll see, so what? And we took them. We took the British government to court. We took the British government through all the stages of the court up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled the British government wouldn't do as it was asked by the Supreme Court, so we had to take them back again and back again and back again. It was a case or a succession of cases that lasted, I don't know, something like 3 years. And finally, the British government accepted that it had to obey its own laws.
Oh, okay. So what did it do?
So it brought in a diesel ban. So it decided that diesel cars would be banned from city centres from some date in the future, 2030 or whatever it was. And this was a great victory for the British people because the air in inner cities was awful and it was giving lots of people asthma and it was contributing to early deaths. Yeah. I mean, it was really dreadful. And so it was a great victory. But it led to two more things. I mean, this is a remarkable story. Because at that stage, the UK was in the EU, and because we had a court decision in the UK, we could use that court decision as a precedent in Europe. So off we went to Europe, bringing actions in one country after another. And this was just at the time of Dieselgate, when the big German motor manufacturers were cheating when the emissions from their cars were tested. And the courts did whatever they could to find in our favour. They wanted to teach these big motor manufacturers a lesson. So diesel bans were introduced in one city after another as we brought these cases. And then the EU saw what was going on and said, it's time to flip from diesel to electric. So we played a role. I don't want to exaggerate what we did, but we had a role, played a role in tipping Europe from diesel cars to electric vehicles. That was there we were affecting a reduction in emissions on a European scale. It was a brilliant success.
Great victory. Even if we talk about electric vehicle with Wade, and it's not the perfect solution neither always.
There is no perfection in this world. You have to move forward in the way that you can move forward. There's a second part to my story, which is that China...
I wanted to come to that, yeah.
So while we were doing this in the UK and in Europe, China phoned us up. A man from China made a call and said, do you know that the Chinese judiciary has been watching what you've been doing? And we said, no, we don't know that. They said, the man said, China has really excellent environmental laws, but they haven't been hasn't been enforcing them. The air quality is very bad in Chinese cities. China now wants to enforce its environmental laws. Would you kindly come, you client Earth, and give a seminar in the Chinese Supreme Court to the Chinese Supreme Court justices on what it is you have been doing?
Yeah.
Which was a remarkable request. So we did that.
Did you doubt of the genuinity of the question?
Well, you know, we said, the man said, I'm from the Chinese Supreme Court. And we said, yes, of course you are. We got to the bottom of it. And we went to Beijing and we went into the Chinese Supreme Court building and there were the justices and we gave a seminar. They were impressed by what they heard. And they said, we'd now like you to train the justices and the prosecutors so that we're right up to the latest international thinking in bringing actions and adjudicating environmental actions, and then we're going to start bringing actions. So we began a training program for their justices and their prosecutors, and after a year or so, they started bringing actions, and they've been bringing 100,000 actions a year, 100,000 prosecutions, and they win 95% of them. And if you do business in China now, you are very, very cautious about what you put up the chimney or what you dump in the river, because the likelihood is you'll be in court if you break the law.
Thanks to you.
Well, no, not thanks to us. Thanks to the decision of the Chinese people and the Chinese judiciary to start enforcing their laws.
Yeah, because at the time, like... Beijing was unbreathable. You couldn't breathe in Beijing, and people were starting to complain a little bit. Yeah,
there was a real social problem, a deep social issue. If you can't breathe, you get upset. I mean, after the Chinese government had made the decision, all we did was provide a little bit of help.
That's funny. They come to see a European organization.
China is absolutely brilliant at looking at the world, seeing what is best out there, and that can be imported into China. They have no problem at all saying there's something very good over there, and we should have the same sort of thing here.
Okay. So a form of humility,
Well, it's a very sensible way of running anything, isn't it? You see somebody else doing something really clever and you say, I can do that if they come and tell me how to do it.
What's the next plan with China?
I need to be clear about something here, which is, of course, there is strategic competition now between the West and China. And the strategic competition has been mounting over the last few years. And we deal with that by being strictly non-political. So if we can help any country around the world, we will do that. When you ask me what is next with China, we will work with them on anything they would like us to, which takes their efforts to reduce emissions and to preserve nature forward. So to give you another example, after we'd been working with the Ministry of Justice for a while, the Ministry of the Environment asked us what we could do. And we said, well, we have a proposal for you. We have noticed that China's Belt and Road Initiative, which is a massive, $1 trillion investment program in 100 countries or something like that around the world, we've noticed that the Belt and Road Initiative. We've noticed that the Belt and Road Initiative is still investing in coal-fired power plants. And do you know, you're going to lose a boatload of money on that, because these power plants are all going to become uneconomic. They're going to be stranded assets. And they said, that's very interesting. Would you mind writing a memorandum to that effect? So we wrote a two-page memorandum, and it was, of course, translated and then fed in to the ministry, and it went right up. And Xi Jinping apparently responded to it and said, we don't want to lose a boatload of money. And down it came again. And then just before the Glasgow Conference of Parties, the climate change conference in, I think, 2021, Xi Jinping announced that the Belt and Road Initiative would no longer finance coal-fired power plants.
Okay.
And you might ask me to what extent our memorandum was responsible for or contributed to that decision. And as an answer, I would tell you that on the Chinese Ministry of the Environment website, they thank us for initiating that in public. So that is remarkable.
Okay.
That one decision touches the lives of people in 100 countries that may not stop them developing their electricity grids using coal, but it will make it a lot more difficult for them. And at the same time, the costs of wind and solar are coming down very rapidly, with the infrastructure also being supplied by China. Just as we contributed to a switch in Europe from diesel-powered vehicles to electric vehicles, we've contributed to a switch from coal-fired generation to clean energy in countries all around the world through the Belt and Road Initiative.
Yeah, because it had been said that China at the time, that China wouldn't build coal in its own country, but would put them in Africa, in Kenya, for example, in Lamu, or things like this. Yeah.
And as it happens, the reverse is now the case. It's not doing them outside China, but it is opening coal-fired power plants very rapidly inside China. That is Chinese domestic policy.
So. Yeah. You were talking about competition. I didn't very understand when you said like there's a competition between China and the West.
Strategic competition.
Yeah, strategic competition. So why do you mention this?
The reason that I use that language is because the US has designated China as a strategic competitor.
Yes.
I mean, that's a sort of
fighting
formal...
for the first place. Yeah.
Well, they are fighting for first place, meaning essentially fighting for the leadership of the world. And the fact that there is, the word fight is the wrong word, it is competition. They are strategic competitors. And, of course, relationships between China and the US in the last 18 months have been taut. They've not been easy. And one would think that since solving the climate problem and indeed solving the problem of the destruction of nature, since that is important to both of them, you might think that even if they are having a difficult time on everything else, on this one single issue, they might come together and together push the world forward.
That could be a good challenge for you.
Thank you. So, interestingly, within the departments of environment, both in China and in the EU, there are regular discussions that take place, you know, how both of them are moving their policy forward. And they wanted a secretary for those discussions who was neutral and acceptable to both. And we're it. We are the secretary to those discussions between the EU and China. And there's something quite remarkable about this, that a little environmental organization, 350 people, with an office sort of just down the road, you would never know it was there, is right in the middle of the dialogue between the EU and China.
Wow.
Yeah.
What an achievement. Yeah. And pressure.
Yes, we're able to do it because we have no angle on this. We just want to see the world in a better place.
Okay, congratulations. That's nice. So let's talk about the clean transition in its broadened sense, maybe. What is wrong today? And if you could have like an ideal shift in the world, if you could suggest like the best idea and the US and China would agree and all the world, what would happen?
If I had a magic wand and could wave it and everybody got
exactly,
on happily.
Exactly, yeah. You got this magic wand.
Sadly, Rose, there is not a magic wand.
So no.
We have to deal with the world as we see it.
Yeah.
So, there's a clean energy transition going on. It's an industrial revolution in its scale. It's taking the backbone of the world economy, the fossil fueled energy system, and it's replacing it. I mean, this is an enormous thing to do. But that's only the first stage of the clean tech transition. The next stage is clean food. In my view, this is only partly talked about and accepted. It's not a current view out in the world, but
okay.
I think it's becoming current, which is that you need to be able to grow food inside, not out in the fields. So in particular, you need to be able to grow meat inside in something called a bioreactor, and provide meat for the world from inside by essentially manufacturing it or culturing it, is the word, rather than from cows and sheep in fields.
So it would be like, sorry, a fake meat?
No. So the way that this is done is you take a sample from a cow.
Okay.
And you use the cells in the sample to put them in a reagent which allows them to multiply and grow, and you create meat that
You're
way.
You're a futurist.
No, it's very presentist. This is happening. The most remarkable thing I have seen in the last few years, two or three years, is a paper which was, I think, in Nature, which had a picture of a Wagyu beefsteak.
Okay.
which had been 3D printed. Okay, it was printed not with ink, but with meat cells and fat cells, which had been grown in a bioreactor.
But with no massage.
The cells... they haven't got to the massage.
Okay.
The cells had been obtained from a live animal without doing it any harm. Now,
and the nutrients are there?
Yes.
Okay.
So this is at an early stage, and the growth medium needed is very costly at the moment. The steak, I think, cost $1 million to make. I mean, Wagyu is expensive, but it's not generally $1 million. You need to have an economic growth medium. You need lots of technology here. But if you can do it at $1 million, you can do it in a few years' time at $10,000 and then $1,000, and you'll end up.
So that's a big hope.
No, it's not a big hope. It's a reasonable expectation given the way that technology has worked over the last 30 years. I don't think it is a big hope. I think you need a bit of luck and a lot of creativity, and you'll get there. And the reason I mention this is for two reasons. You need to sort out the food supply chain and bring it indoors rather than outdoors for two reasons. One is to take the pressure off nature. If you produced all meat in the way I've just been describing, you could reforest all of pasture land. That would solve half of climate change because the growing trees would suck down carbon. That would be amazing. It would sort out biodiversity loss. And the third thing, if you did that, it would give enormous food security. You could do this in any country, in any place. And as the climate changes and makes growing food in a field more difficult, you'd be able to grow it inside. So this is speculative. This is looking...
The best scenario possible. Okay.
This is looking a decade or two forward, but I suspect there will be rapid progress here.
Yeah, so do you think our grandchildren could potentially eat that kind of meat?
There's a restaurant in Singapore selling chicken nuggets made this way.
Okay, all right.
Now, not for our grandchildren.
Very expensive
nuggets. You can go there and eat it yourself.
Okay, wow, crazy. Do you think science will solve the problem of environment?
Nothing will solve the problem. There's no one thing that will solve the problem. But the scientists and the technologists and the entrepreneurs are amazingly creative. Yeah. And in the laboratories now, at universities around the world, are all sorts of new ideas being developed.
Yeah.
So one new idea being developed in Canada is deep geothermal energy. So one associates geothermal energy with bubbling pools or bubbling lava close to the surface. But if you drill down far enough, you can find hot rock, 7-10 kilometers. There's a completely new technology which people are trying to develop and then make economic, which would allow you to drill holes anywhere in the world and use geothermal. That's one idea. There are lots of ideas out there. I'm very, very optimistic. The technologists and entrepreneurs will keep providing new ideas. The trick is now to get the politics in place to push this transition forward fast enough.
I will finish with the harvest of the day, which is, what's your favorite tool for self-transformation, or transforming the planet or ourselves?
Can I do self-transformation?
Yes.
So my favorite tool for self-transformation is my wife,
who Veronica.
Ever gives me guidance on how I need to transform myself.
Okay, but I think you're doing enough to transform the planet, so we can give you this one. And well done, Veronica. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
For this very informative and optimistic interview.
Thank you for joining us on this episode exploring Howard Covington's captivating journey. I am far from being an environmental role model. I find the task sometimes so immense that it seems discouraging. But somehow, Howard, suing governments, has found his successful way of action and manages to stay positive in the short term. If you find value in this conversation, we'd greatly appreciate your support. Kindly leave us a positive review and connect with us on Instagram at Harvest Series. Our podcast is also available for viewing on youtube.com/harvestseries. Looking ahead, our next episode features the incredible Athena Ko, also known as the Gong Girl. Prepare to be enchanted by the story of this powerful and wise individual, formerly a luminary in the New York City banking industry, now leading sound meditation and making a difference in psychiatric wards. Don't miss out on the wisdom she has to share in our upcoming episode. Thank you for being a part of the Harvest Series communities, and until next time, stay tuned for more enriching conversations.